You're listening to Stop Feeding the Predators on City of Angels Recovery Radio. The phone number for Stop Feeding the Predators is 614-403-4545. My name is Lynn, and today we have a special guest, and this will be a one-hour show. Justin is here to talk with us. Justin, thank you for being here.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
I met Justin, we were just talking about how long it's been. I met Justin about almost eight years ago, and fell in love with him immediately, because the very first thing that he said to me is, when I grow up, I don't want to be like my dad. And I thought that was an incredible thing for a young teen man to say. And he said, you know, my dad made some mistakes in life, and I don't want to do that. I want more for myself. I want better for my life. And ever since then, I've seen Justin go through some ups and downs. Lots of ups, lots of downs. The downs were really big. The ups were a little bit smaller. But that's changing. That's changing. And I want everyone to know, the show today talks primarily about addiction, with the emphasis on heroin addiction. And this is a show about hope. So if you have someone in your life who's using heroin, if you're the one that's using heroin or any drug, I encourage you to listen to the show, to share it with those that you love. The enablers in your life that are making your drug use very successful, please share this show with them, because we hope to address some of that as well. So, I've told everyone how we met, and I don't really know exactly where to start. So if you want to start with where we met, you can, or if you want to talk about why you wanted more for your life, or we can just start right in with the addiction issue. It's up to you.
I didn't want to be like my dad, primarily because I saw the way that it changed my mom's life, and I knew that I wanted to be a better man than that. I wanted to make my significant other happy, whatever the cost. I knew that I wanted to be there for my kids. I knew what a father was supposed to be, even though I didn't have one. So that's kind of the reasoning behind that. Now, I mean, we met under circumstances where you wouldn't normally like me. But it was definitely one of the better things that have happened to me in life, was meeting you. You've definitely had positive influences on my life, and I wouldn't be where I'm at right now, especially if it weren't for you.
You do know I've been winging it the whole time, right?
You
do know I have no clue what I've done to help you. I've just made mistakes left and right, and it's fallen to my favor, I guess.
I mean, yeah, and that's kind of where things are happening for me now too, is that I'm making what you would consider rash decisions, but not the wrong kind. So, you know, living it minute by minute, I guess, but at the same time thinking through exactly what the outcome of those actions are going to be.
Right.
So
one day at a time, right?
Yeah, one day at a time. Exactly.
Now, you mentioned that you knew what a father was supposed to be, and that was your goal. What qualities did you see that a man should have to be a good father?
He should be there for his kids. For anything, they should be able to call you and say, I had a bad day at school, and you're there to listen. Something that small, or something big. Dad, I just got into a car wreck. What do I do? You know, you're supposed to be supportive and make sure that your children, your life is as successful as it can be. Not only for yourself, but to be able to influence your children to be better people. You know, you want your kids to be better than you. So if you hold high standards for that, and they do it, then it only makes it that much better.
Raising healthy, successful children is every parent's goal, and we can't do that if we're still struggling with the things that keep us crazy, you know? And I don't mean crazy in the, you know, documented terms. I just mean the stuff that makes us kind of unsettled about ourselves. We have to get that settled to be able to be a good parent for them.
Definitely.
Now, when you and I first met, and again, that was about 7 or 8 years ago, you were 17.
Mm-hmm.
You were, if I may use the horrible expression, you were an average teenager, if I may use that horrible expression. You were a guy.
Yeah.
You were a teenager. You were learning what life's about and figuring out your place and where you wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And since we're going to talk about drug addiction, when I met you, I was kind of under the impression that you might sneak a beer now and then, you possibly smoked pot if you could. But when you and I met, there was no hint of what was to come as far as drug use in your future. Can you remember at 17, what was, you know, people talk about marijuana as the gateway drug or alcohol is the gateway drug or things like that. Is there such a thing as a gateway drug? Is there something that, or did it just kind of all snowball?
The marijuana as a gateway drug, that's iffy for me, because back then I definitely wouldn't see it as that. But where I'm at now in my recovery, I know that the slightest slip up could send me right back to where I was if I so much as smoke weed now and I say, okay, that's acceptable, to get high this way is okay, then chances are before I know it I'll be using again, saying this is acceptable, I like this.
Right.
So being an addict now, I would tell you, yes, in my circumstance it's a gateway drug. I can almost guarantee that if I were to smoke weed today, that tomorrow I'd probably be doing heroin.
Be right back into it.
Yeah.
And I've talked in other shows that I've done, I've talked about addiction, regardless of what you're addicted to, whether it's, you know, heroin, alcohol, smoking. People don't consider smoking an addiction very much, but when people try to quit and they can't,
yeah,
that's an addiction. But there's also addictions of, you know, food and sex and pornography, and there's even addictions as far as people. You know, I had some of that in my past where I didn't feel okay unless a certain person was in my life on a regular basis. And I've talked about people who were sexually assaulted when they were children. We tend to look for something that makes us feel normal again, because when you're a child and you're sexually assaulted, you lose that sense of being okay in your skin. You lose that feeling that you're all right just as you are as a human being. And we spend a lot of time trying to fix that. And some people become overachievers, which is wonderful. But when all the success and money in the world doesn't complete them and make them feel happy, then they bottom out. The same as, you know, those of us who get into sex addiction and drug addiction and alcohol addiction. We're trying to find that thing that makes us feel okay again. And I appreciate that you said that you wouldn't necessarily consider marijuana a gateway drug, but you can see how, if that's acceptable, what else is acceptable? And I've mentioned in my shows before, if you stop doing heroin, alcohol, whatever, and you replace it with food, or you replace it with sex, or you replace it with, you're just trading addictions. And I know there's, is it methadone that they used to treat? Methadone clinics, where I've had people tell me that now they're addicted to methadone.
Yep.
And the drive is the same, and the reason for use is the same, and it's, you've just traded drugs. It's a little less destructive, which is great, but you're still addicted to something, and that's no better than saying, well, I'm not an alcoholic because I only drink beer. I used to drink whiskey, but I quit that, so obviously I can control my alcohol. When you look at the addictive nature, and you don't have to go into graphic details or anything, but was there something that you were trying to fix, or was this all experimental? I mean, again, there's teenagers that are like, you know, my life is good, nothing's really wrong, and they start dabbling in drugs or whatever, or they hang with the wrong crowd, supposed to quote-unquote hang with the wrong crowd. But was there, looking back, was there something that you were trying to fix or feel differently or not feel, or was this just you stumbled into it and it snowballed? And I don't mean to use that term, but yeah, sometimes that happens, you know?
That's kind of a tough question for me to answer, because by all means, I was doing all right. I was doing okay. I had a really good job. I was making, you know, $15 an hour as a cook. I had everything. You know, I was really close with my family. I had a girlfriend who was just absolutely amazing, and I was living what I would consider to be the middle class success story, I guess, you know, the middle class dream.
Yeah.
And I had money.
You had the job, the money, and the girl.
Yeah, I was cool. And I wasn't really hanging out with the wrong people. Everybody that I was talking to, I mean, they would smoke weed. I would smoke weed every now and again, but there was no partying, drinking every weekend, and nobody in my immediate circle using heroin or pills or anything like that, or, you know, just, it kind of come out of nowhere. You know, I think, me personally, I was getting high on success. You know, I was doing all right, and I was loving it. It made me feel good. And then things stopped going so well, and I wasn't used to that. I wasn't used to things not working out in my favor. And, I mean, that's kind of when it started. I ended up, I thought I was making a good career choice by switching jobs. I tried to work at Best Buy as computer sales, and I worked there for 4 months and didn't receive a paycheck. So I actually ended up losing both of those jobs because I left one for the other and then didn't go back for not getting paid. Me and my girlfriend at the time, we had a big fight and she moved out. And that was it. I mean, story written. That was the night it all started. I remember somebody I was living with at the time said, "Hey, you know, you don't look like you're doing too well. You want to get high?" And I said, "We don't have any weed." And he's like, "No, man, I got this little piece of a 30, a Percocet 30 you can have." And I snorted it, and it was over. I didn't realize there was a problem until it was too late. Nothing I could do about it, because then it was, like I said, it was acceptable to me. It made me feel good. I was feeling really bad. Nothing was going the way it should have been going. And this was what made me feel, you know, all right. So I was using every day, you know, snorting every day, because things weren't going the way they were supposed to be going. And then one day I wake up and I'm not feeling so good. I think I'm coming on with a flu or something, and that's when I'm warned about the withdrawals. And that was it.
Now, when you say that you were using to feel good, and again, I'm asking you to think backwards,
yeah,
for how many years, to a completely different state of mind, looking back, do you remember if you actually felt good, or did you just not feel bad anymore?
I'd like to think that I felt good. I'd like to think there was a reason that I continued to do it. You know, I like to think that I felt good.
Well, not feeling bad is a good reason to do something. You know, yeah. I don't speed, so I won't get a ticket because I don't want to feel bad.
Right.
You know? I mean, there is something positive about not feeling bad.
Yeah. I mean, I like to think that I felt good. Couldn't tell you. I think I was too high to even know.
Altered your thinking to where you couldn't even decide if it was a good thing or a bad thing. You just kept doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know there's going to be a lot of people listening to the show who want to know why. That's the biggest thing with drug use, with any big thing, you know, but with drug use especially, you know, you have people who say, you know, why?
Me, I'm a believer in the fact that the first use is a choice, sure, but we're all wired a little differently. We're all different. Some have different chemical makeups in their brains than others, and some people are just more prone to addiction than others. Me, looking back on it now, I feel like I was almost addicted from that very first time. And so, you ask why, I say my personal story is because things weren't going well. I used the first time then. And from then, I felt like I needed it from the start.
It was a have to, not a want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And after you pass that threshold where it's no longer to feel good, but to feel normal, that is the way of life from then on out. That's exactly what it is that it's not me for the past, you know, the 5 years that I used, the last four of it, I didn't ever get high. I was just normal. I was just, well, what was then normal, what I thought was normal. And, I mean, it's a terrible way to live. It really is. But, I mean, that's kind of the train of thought when it comes down to that. It's not that a significant other doesn't mean enough to us to stop using, or that we don't necessarily, you know, it's not that we don't want to stop. It's just that that's what we know now. That's what we know to be normal. That's what we know will make us feel as if there's nothing wrong.
So you're saying if I loved you more, that wouldn't have helped you stop any sooner?
No.
And if I gave you more money or did more things for you to help you, that wouldn't have made you stop any sooner? If I paid for you to go to rehab...
No.
Okay.
That would have never been enough.
So for parents who are listening who think, you know, well, I've sent my daughter through rehab twice now, this third time's going to take, she's serious about it this time. You know, we hold out hope for them, of course.
Unfortunately. I don't like the saying that you have to let an addict hit rock bottom. I hate that. Because, as you know, for me, rock bottom would have been death. And I had accepted that.
Right.
I had fully accepted that any of the days that I was alive and using, that I could have died. And unfortunately, that would have been my rock bottom. You can't do that either. You've got to say it in a way for... You got to hope from a distance.
Okay.
You sit there and hound them. Like me, I used to hate it because my girlfriend, I mean, she'd remind me every day. You're using, you know, you don't love me. You love the heroin more than you love me. That's not true.
Did you?
No.
But you loved the heroin more than you loved yourself.
Absolutely. Especially after you're already in that cycle. don't think that we don't feel shame for what we do either. We don't have to be reminded that we did something wrong. We already feel bad for it. And then for somebody to look at you and say, you need help because you did this to me. I already feel bad because I did that to you.
It just adds to the guilt.
Now you're making me feel worse, and I'm going to try. Now what I need to do is go and get high to forget the fact that I did that to you, because I can't live with myself right now.
Right. It makes it worse.
Yeah, it really does.
So constant reminding of your shortcomings is not a good way.
It will never work. It will never work.
And loving you more. What if, and again, this is one of those what if, okay, it's what if Wednesday. If I had said you could live with me and I'll help you out, because for a while you were without a place to live, would that have helped if I'd moved you in with me?
No. Because one of two things would have happened. Either I'd have looked at you and said, I don't want to risk that chance. I'd rather continue to live on the streets and to be able to use. Mm-hmm. Or I'd have told you that was fine and snuck away whenever I could to use. There's that moment where you're watching a cartoon and the little light bulb goes off above the cartoon character's head. He's just had the brilliant idea. That's the attic. That's where it has to be for them. It finally switches where this is not the life I need to be living. I could be doing so much more right now. And still from there, it takes time. Because they know they could be somewhere else. They just have to figure out how to get there. What it's going to take for them. Every case is going to be different. My case is different from everybody else's out there.
Right. Right.
So it's by a case-by-case basis, but most likely they'll get there on their own. You don't have to remind them that they're screwing up and that, you know, you've made their life a living hell or anything like that. Just, like I said, hope from a distance. Not too much pressure.
Now, you made a comment earlier that I've been beneficial in your life. Mm-hmm. I'm not asking this for an ego trip for myself. Mm-hmm. This is for other enablers. Can you give some examples of things that I've done that have been helpful? And can you also give some examples of things that have not been helpful, whether it was me or someone else? So that parents who are listening, who are trying to help their kids get sober, get clean, get back on their feet and not die, give them some. What do I do? What do I don't do? And again, case by case is going to be different, but there's certain patterns of what's not helpful. And reminding somebody constantly that they're an addict is clearly not helpful. They already know that.
When I would call, you'd answer the phone. And if I said, hey, I'm having a really bad day today, you were there. You'd offer to pick me up, take me to a meeting, you know, buying food or something just to talk. I mean, that little stuff, it goes a long way. It sounds so small, but you feel so alone after becoming an addict. You feel like there's just nobody's on your side anymore. It's you against the world. And to have somebody just willing to go the distance but not enable at the same time, is, it's a big deal. I mean, it left a pretty big impression on me.
So you knew that I cared, but I didn't try to take over.
Yeah.
What were some things that were not helpful that people in your life had done? And by people, I mean people who genuinely love you and were trying to be helpful. What were some of the... We've already talked about the constant reminders.
Yeah. As bad as it's going to sound, that even just the handing of money to an addict. My girlfriend used to hand me money. I mean, that's what I wanted.
But not for the reason that she was giving you the money.
Right. I could go and use. I could go and get high and be whatever. But it's not the same. You can't buy. It's the double-edged sword thing. You're going to give me money, but you want me to get sober. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't. You can't buy my love because I need dope. You can't buy me to go to rehab. You can't. It's very unbeneficial, because if she'd have given me money and I went and bought heroin and then died, she would be crushed. If I had gone and done something to get that money, she would have known that was based off my own actions, but she would continue to think for the rest of her life, what if I didn't give him that money? That's like the biggest no-no. And I wouldn't have told you that last year.
No, because last year you were still wanting the money.
Yeah, I wouldn't have told you that last year, but now, I mean, seeing it for what it is, that's a big difference.
So hanging out at Burger King and buying you a cheeseburger is okay and helpful and helps you know somebody's there for you, but mm-hmm. giving you $10 and expecting that you're going to buy yourself a hamburger later unrealistic.
Absolutely. Because I'll tell you what, it wouldn't matter how much money I had in my pocket either. I could have $100 and not have eaten in the past 3 days. I'm going to go spend that $100 on dope, and I'll find a way to eat later.
Yeah. It becomes all you think about.
That's
all
it.
You do.
I mean, it's almost like food. It feels almost as if it's a necessity for us to survive at that point.
It's the thing that makes you feel okay. Okay, we talked about a little bit about how you first got into it. Tell me, you've told me what it's like using, but tell me about what point did your life, give me, if you want to, and if you don't, that's okay. What is the average week of an addict? And I'm going to say week instead of a day, because
right.
to define an average day, you know, it doesn't really cover it.
Yeah.
What's an average week of an addict's life like?
You
wake up in the morning, and what's the first thing?
It depends. Because I wake up in the morning and I've either got a little bit of heroin left from last night, or I don't. Now, heroin comes first.
So that sets the tone for your day.
Period. I go up there, lock myself in the bathroom, I use heroin, then I pee, then I brush my teeth, take a shower, whatever I have to do. But heroin comes first. Now, if I don't have that, my train of thought is, get it. Whatever it takes. So, first I'm going to make my phone calls. I'm going to call my drug dealer and see if he'll loan me bags of dope. And if he says no, then I'm going to call anybody I possibly can to try to borrow some money. Now, sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. It doesn't work. Then, now it's time to start thinking like an addict. How can I get money without ending up in jail? And that's difficult, for one. There are people that stand outside and hold their little signs up and stuff, and that was never me. I like to steal. That was what I did. So It's been 30 minutes since I woke up. I'm now on my way to a store. I'm going to go and steal something. Hope that I don't get caught. And go from there. Now, it's maybe maybe an hour after I woke up, I'm ready to go and get heroin now. I finally have money. I go and pick up. I wouldn't even leave the area. I would go behind an abandoned house right next door to his house. Didn't care who saw. I mean, this abandoned house is surrounded by houses with people living in them, kids living in them. And I'd pull my little spoon out, my little needle out, and use right there, broad daylight, where everybody could see me. And then you wait that 30 seconds that it takes to kick in, and then you're like, all right, cool, now I need some more. I know I'm going to be sick if I don't. And you're on it again.
That quickly.
I mean, I would go...
You've just used, you yep. know you're going to be okay for the next, 4 hours? I don't yep. know how long it lasts. So you've just used, you know you're going to be okay for 4 hours, mm-hmm. and your very first thought is, I'm okay, I have to get more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the sad part is that there are days where, like, I couldn't come up with more than, like, $30, and I would somehow make that last the entire day, and then the next day I'd end up with, like, $150, and it would still only get me through the day, if that.
So the amount of heroin you were using depended on how much money you were able to get, not how much you needed to yep. feel okay.
I like to smoke cigarettes. I wouldn't even buy cigarettes. I would just bum cigarettes from anybody I saw smoking. I was buying heroin, and that was it. Didn't matter. Did not matter.
Not food, not warm socks.
Nothing.
Just
heroin. And it's a sad thing to look back on it and say, all right, I couldn't even imagine how many people saw me back there using, and I just didn't care. I had to get to the quickest place that I could get to in order to do it. Even if I was okay, even if I was well, even if I had just bought some an hour and a half ago, now I'm back with more money, I'm right back there doing it again. It's a sad life to live, it really is. And it's important for people to know that. We know what we're doing. We just don't know how to get out. 9 out of 10 people you ask that are addicts, they're going to tell you they don't want to live the life they're living, but they don't want to go through the withdrawal. I was scared of withdrawing. I hated withdrawing. I really did.
Yeah, I remember there were lots of times that I was asked for cleaning supplies to clean up cars and carpets and couches. And
I hated it.
You know, for someone who's not an addict, sudden vomiting is a really big deal.
Yeah.
And good and bad, I knew what was going on at the time. But I remember one of the first times before I really was aware of what was going on, I remember you asked for some cleaner because your friend threw up in your car.
Yep.
And I was like, oh my gosh, is his friend okay? Is he really sick? Did he go to the hospital? What's he got? I mean, is he feeling better? Was it food poisoning? And I mean, I was so oblivious to what was actually happening. But again, to a person who doesn't experience, I can't even tell you the last time I threw up. And you know, if I was violently ill with food poisoning or something big and traumatic happened, to think of that as being part of your life, if you don't get what you need to feel okay, you're vomiting. And tell me some of the other withdrawal feelings, symptoms.
The doctors like to say it's like a flu, but a little worse. And I've had the flu before, and it's not even close. I mean, there were times where I seriously contemplated suicide because I was withdrawing. I mean, you get so uncomfortable. You're hot, and then you'll take something off, and you're freezing cold, but you're still sweating. You're just constantly sweating. You can't get comfortable. You can't sleep. You got what they consider to be restless leg syndrome. You are constantly kicking your legs around. They will not stop. You can't sleep. You're puking all the time. Snot running out your nose, crying a lot. Your sinuses get all inflamed.
What's the crying from? Just happens?
Yeah, it just happens.
You're not feeling sad or feeling bad for where you are. You just can't control it.
Yeah, just can't stop crying. It's so bad. I remember there's some of my worst use. I would have to shower like 10 times a day because I would just stink so bad from sweating. And it really does. The withdrawal sweats smell a lot worse than like normal sweat too. It just stinks.
Well, you're sweating out the
the
drugs.
Yeah.
You know, your body's finally not processing it. You're releasing it.
Yeah. You got a constant headache. Won't go away.
And I'm sure there's lots of moms out there going, well, honey, if you'd eat something, you'd feel better.
No appetite whatsoever. I mean, for one, you already think, what's the point? It's just going to come right back up. And two, you just have no appetite. You do not feel like eating. You don't feel like walking. You feel like doing absolutely nothing. You will just lay in bed. That's it. You'll try to sleep. It's not happening. You might sleep 2 hours out of the night, maybe. And it's not even that you've got all this energy or anything. You just cannot close your eyes and fall asleep. It's terrible. That's part of what I think of every time I'm like, all right, I got to stay sober today because I definitely don't want to be withdrawing tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's like one of the top three or four things on my list that I'm grateful to be sober for is that I don't have to withdraw in the morning. That's a serious deal.
When you said that you would steal to get money, and you made a comment that you hoped you wouldn't get caught, were you afraid of going to prison, or were you just afraid of not being able to get to use that day?
Part of me was scared to go to jail or prison, you know, part of me was, but part of me was more worried about, crap, if I get arrested, I'm not going to get anything.
And now you have to go through all those withdrawal symptoms
in
a holding cell.
Yeah.
So you weren't necessarily afraid of jail, you were afraid of not being able to use to get through the day.
Yeah.
So you did end up going to jail.
I did.
Because things caught up with you.
Yeah. I ended up with two felony charges within like a year of each other. And the course of that year in between those two felony charges, I think I got, I want to say it's something like 12 theft cases. And the felony cases they put me on probation for, most of the misdemeanor cases got dismissed. Then they put me on a provided no convictions deal, which is just don't get caught stealing again and you're fine. Now, for one, the probation was already a problem because I was using. And two, the provided no convictions was don't get caught stealing again. And that's like, oh, what now? So I go to my first probation appointment. They already knew that I was using, so they knew I was not going to be clean. So I didn't go to my second or third appointment. I stopped answering his phone calls and everything.
And this is a probation officer?
Yeah.
Okay.
My felony probation. And then I got caught stealing three more times and receiving stolen property. When I got caught stealing, they arrested me for three outstanding warrants for theft because I didn't go to court on them because I knew that if I got convicted, I was going to jail. So, yeah, that's logic there. Just don't go. And while I was there, the probation officer violated me for not showing up to probation. So I didn't really know when I was going to leave there either.
Can I, if you don't want me to say this, I won't, but can I ask you to share the day you got arrested? Where were you? And I don't mean area of town, but where were you and where were you heading the day you got arrested?
Because
that's a big deal to me.
I was actually, I had texted you, what, the night before?
Yeah.
And I said, hey, you know, I think tomorrow's the day. I want to go to a meeting and maybe drop me off at NetCare tomorrow.
And for people who don't know, NetCare is beginning rehab for recovery.
It was like 6:30 at night or something, and I told you I'd meet you at like 8 or something.
Right.
Something like that.
Right.
I got caught stealing from a Kroger store, and I was going...
On your way to a...
Going...
Meeting.
Yeah. I was actually gonna have you meet me at the library right next to where I was buying drugs and go from there.
But see, that's... You're laughing and shaking your head, but to me, that emphasizes so much the hopeless and wanting hope at the same time of addiction. You're saying, this is it. I need help. I want to go to a meeting. After the meeting, let's go get me started in rehab. And on the way, you're still using. You're still... Even though you want to be done, like you said, you want to be done.
Unfortunately, the system that we have now, at least the way I feel, rehabs aren't hitting the key points that they should be hitting. So even if you look at it and you say, I do want help, my train of thought is, all right, I want to get help. I'm going to call Mary Haven, which is a rehab. They're on a 30-day waiting list. I want help today. But now I've got to manage to make it through 30 more days before I can go to rehab.
And 30 more days of waking up
and
trying to feel normal.
Yeah.
Which is going to be drug use on a regular basis until the bed's available.
And then you look at it and you see that, for one, the success rates aren't even that high. And I think Mary Haven has like a 13% success rating after 2 years. They obviously aren't hitting many of the points that need to be dealt with in an addict's life. So you feel hopeless from the start because you're already waiting forever. And then to see that, what are the chances that I'm part of that 13%? I've got a much better chance of being part of the majority.
Right.
Why even try? It feels hopeless. It really does. There has to be some serious changes. There needs to be... It needs to be dealt with a case-by-case basis. I think that's step number one. Because throwing people in group therapy sessions and then sending them back to a bed, that's not doing it.
You and I talked before that drug use, like every addiction, is a symptom of the root
mm-hmm.
of whatever it is that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I know many of the rehab places don't have the means, the money, the time, the staff
mm-hmm.
to get to the root of the problem.
Yeah, I was actually doing a lot of research before I went to jail. And there's like 8 major rehabs in the entire United States that deal with dual diagnosis.
Right.
That's a big thing right there.
Right.
Depression, you know, some sort of mental disorder, schizophrenia, stuff like that. Chances are an addict isn't just an addict because he wants to be an addict.
Right. There's something else that's happened.
And there's not enough there. There isn't.
Right. And I don't want you to go into detail. If you want to go into detail, you're welcome to, but I don't want you to go into detail if you don't. I'm just going to ask a yes or no question. Was there something that happened to you when you were younger that made you feel like you were not okay? You're not schizophrenic. You're not,
no.
You know, you were talking about dual diagnosis, you know, depression and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's chemical imbalance. There's mm-hmm. reasons. There's also, you know, like in my past, I had things happen that made me not feel okay with who I mm-hmm. was. And I took a different path than drug use.
Right.
But you said that you had the job, the money, the girl, things were going great.
Yeah.
Was there something prior to that that made you feel like you weren't okay? So that when you had these successes, it felt good, and then it started to go away, and you had to fall back on who you were before you had those successes with the girl, the job, the money?
Unfortunately, yeah.
You don't have to share if you don't want. I'm not asking to put you on the spot to share. I'm just asking because some people will listen and they'll say, well, you know, he started using drugs because he lost his girlfriend, he lost his job.
Yeah.
But there's more to it.
Yeah.
And when rehab centers and enablers want to help addicts, we can't just say, well, Justin, you know, I know it was tough when you lost your job and your girlfriend moved out, but you can get past that because we're still treating symptoms.
Right.
So I think it's important for people to understand, even though, as we've been talking, you said that was pretty much the catalyst, there was actually something prior to that that made you not feel okay. And when you had these successes, you felt like you'd achieved it. You're good.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to make it. You're going to be okay. And when you're going to be okay started falling by the wayside, you're back to not feeling okay.
Yeah.
We only have about 10 minutes left. But I want you to tell me a little more about prison. Sorry, jail. There's a difference. There's a difference. I wrote prison, it's jail. You went to jail.
Mm-hmm.
You said prior to going to jail, you didn't want to go to jail because it would interfere with your drug use.
Mm-hmm.
The first couple days you were in jail, if you don't mind me saying, I got phone calls saying, get me the hell out of here now. I am not using. It's been 48 hours. I am clean. I'm done. I get it. I understand. I'm not going to use again. I need to be out of here. I'll deal with this from outside jail. I don't need to be here to deal with it. Give me a little more of what it was like being in jail. Because I wasn't going to get you out. I was not getting you out. And not only was I not getting you out, I said prayers every night that no one else would either.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's running sayings, you know, oh, you get three hots in a cot, it's not that bad. It is that bad. It really is. You don't... All right, if you're homeless and you're not eating, like, all right, that's cool, you know, if that's where you want to be. But it's... I mean... It's worse than you could ever really imagine. Like, all right, your day starts off at 5 in the morning. There's your breakfast tray, all right? 10 o'clock, you're eating lunch. At 4 p.m., you're eating dinner. So you're already starving because they barely feed you. They feed you just enough to survive. So you're starving by next morning. The lights never go out. And you don't realize how hard it is to sleep with all that light until you're stuck there. And all there is to do is look at the ceiling anyway. You will drive yourself absolutely mad. It's so not cool. It's unfun. It's not glamorous. It's not cool. It's not fun. There is nothing to do. And you're stuck in... Me, I was stuck in a room with 30 other dudes who are breathing, farting, stinking. It's...
And everybody has an attitude, I'm
exactly.
sure.
Exactly. Everybody's trying to be reason. Big man, big dog, whatever you want, you know. It's... you're sleeping on 2 inches of little cotton wrapped in plastic, you know, the like vinyl stuff, and it's on a metal bunk with somebody else sleeping on top of you. Not
not right on top of you.
Not right on top, but a bunk bed. You know, it sucks.
Tell me about what changed that made you okay to not use again. Not everybody who goes to jail or even prison comes out and stays clean.
I don't know that I could. It just clicked. It just did. It was the sudden realization that I was actually okay with living a life where I could die at any moment. I'd leave behind nothing for my daughter. Nothing. Seeing all the people coming after me doing the exact same thing and realizing I looked like that, I smelled like that, I acted like that, I sounded like that when I talked. Everything that ever come out of those people's mouths was something about heroin. And I wondered, like, wow, did I really just talk about heroin all day? Like, I couldn't even really tell you. It just all added up at the exact same time. I was done. That it was not beneficial to me. I was down to 120 pounds at 5'10.5". I looked like death. I felt like death. And I was in trouble.
And you were missing out.
I was missing out on everything. To have to hear your daughter call you dada through a phone, like... And then you're worried about the 30 other dudes in the room who want to use the phone, too. It all clicked. I was not meant to be there. I shouldn't be living like that. And then one day it was just, I broke down and said, I don't know what it's going to take, but help me. I didn't even know who I was talking to. And after that, it was just like my eyes were open. I didn't need it. Didn't want it. I was going to be fine without it.
When you say you didn't know who you were talking to, do you know now?
Yeah. I found my God. And that is the worst place to find him, but I found him. I guess other people would argue with you and say it's the best place to find him. There's nothing else to do in there.
I was going to say, God tends to come into a lot of people's lives in jail and in prison.
Mm-hmm.
I think the difference is, do you take him with you when you leave there, decides whether or not you stay the person that you want to be, or you go back to who you used to be that you don't like, that you didn't want to be.
I gave up in there, hoping to leave. I had no idea when I was going to leave, and for a minute there, I was waking up every day like, all right, they're going to call me, I'm going to go to court, I'm going to get released, blah, 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 blah. And I just stopped hoping for it. I literally just would go to bed every night, and I'd think to myself, you know, God'll do what he's supposed to do for me. If I need to sit here, then I need to sit here. If I'm here for another 24 hours, I'm here for another 24 hours. Nothing I can do about it. And I remember being there. It was probably like 20 days or something before that realization was like, all right, stop hoping to wake up in the morning and just, you know. And then one day it just happened. I had court. And I remember going to court, and I'm like, I wouldn't be going to court unless God was going to let me out today. There's no reason I'd be driving down here. That's exactly what I asked him for. Just do what you have to do for me. You know, I'm leaving it in your hands. And I remember going to court, and I'm like, all right, you know, today's the day. And I thought it was, even after leaving court, and I was still there another day, waiting to go to court the next day. Maybe I needed that extra 24 hours, I don't know. But I knew that God was going to do for me what was necessary. He had given me signs before, I just hadn't listened. I hadn't been paying attention. I hadn't paid any mind to it. He gave me plenty of chances to do it on my own, so he saved my life by locking me up.
I remember thinking when you said, yeah, I want to go to a meeting, and then afterwards, you know, we'll go to rehab. I remember thinking, when I heard that you got arrested, that God secretly knew that you were going to change your mind, and he made sure you didn't.
Yeah, I made a commitment.
Because you went from saying that you wanted to get clean and sober and change your life to actually having very few other options, at least for those next 50-some days.
Yeah, and that's the problem with the life you live that way, because they say... I think I told you this. They say the third time is a charm, but, like, you sit there and you look at the clock and you're like, all right, maybe the 600,000th time is a charm. Like, you just never know what's going to happen tomorrow. And in the next 5 minutes, you just don't know. You could die at any minute. You don't know what's in the stuff. I mean, there was even a point where I was friends with my drug dealer. He was my best friend. For one, that's like, wow, that's bad. And two, I'm watching him put stuff in there, and I'm still doing it. Like, it's bad. It's a bad life to live. It's not fun. And that weighs on your mind, too. Like, man, I could die at any minute, but people mistake you for not caring. And it's not that you don't care. It's just that you don't feel like you're in a position to do anything about it.
You didn't use because you... didn't love your family, you used because you needed to feel normal.
Yeah.
To feel or not feel.
Yeah.
We've only got a few minutes left. How can people help if someone that they love is an addict? Or how can they avoid making it worse? Don't nag the person. Don't constantly remind them they're an addict.
Yeah.
I'm going to interject, don't ask them why they're still using.
Yeah.
Because you've already said it's not really a choice, so they don't know why.
Yeah.
So there's your answer. Anybody who's listening who wants to know, why is my beautiful child still using drugs? Why is this, you know, handsome young man with a bright future ahead of him still using drugs? The answer to why, I'll tell you, you're all listening, write it down. Because he is. That is why. There is no answer. It's what's happening. So stop focusing on the symptom of why. Get to the root. So they can answer the phone when the person calls. What about the addict that calls up and says, Mom, I need $10. I'm starving. Mom, can you give me a gift card for Wendy's for $5? What's going to happen to that Wendy's gift card for $5?
Yeah.
That goes to food. I know it does. It's a gift card for Wendy's. What else can you do with it? I gave my kid a $20 gift card for Wendy's.
No.
It doesn't go to Wendy's?
No.
Where does it go?
It goes to the drug dealer. I mean...
And what's it worth to the drug dealer?
It's worth $2.50.
So the $10, $20 gift card I gave my child so that I know, so I'd feel better that they're eating.
Yeah. You give me a $20 gift card, I can get you $10 worth. If that. If he wants the Wendy's gift card.
And if he's on a diet or he doesn't like Wendy's...
You're going to go sell it to somebody else on the street. You're going to stand out in front of Wendy's and ask him, wants to buy a $20 gift card for $10.
And I'll even go in Wendy's to verify the amount on the card. Yeah, so exactly. You know it's a $20 gift card.
Exactly. It's bad.
So, but we can take you to Wendy's.
Yeah.
Eat with you.
Yep. Putting money in my hand is probably the worst idea. You know?
So giving you a Wendy's gift card says I'm enabling and meeting you at Wendy's and buying you a sandwich. Even if you don't show up when I'm there, you at least know that I cared enough to do that, even though you're probably ticked off that I won't give you any money and I was just going to buy you a cheeseburger and then you leave.
Yep.
Because I've heard of people saying, you know, well, I was supposed to meet them and they never showed.
Yeah.
We are technically out of time. We've run over. But when I asked you earlier to give some hope, you said something and it really hit home. So if you would share that again.
Life is not over. It's not over. There's so much you can do. There's still so much you can change. It's a big deal. I mean, every step matters. Even the little stuff. Just because you're an addict doesn't mean that it's over. It's a harmful way to think that since you're an addict, you'll be an addict forever. That's a really bad way to think of it. You gotta find hope. And you will. I did. My life's turned out pretty good already.
And how are you able to make it through each day? I mean, do you plan your week? Do you?
I don't. I take it one day at a time.
And for today, you're not using.
That's right.
And that's all that matters.
Yep.
Tomorrow, you'll worry about tomorrow.
That's right.
I want to thank you so much.
Sure.
I didn't cry. I was on the verge so many times. I'm like, not going to crack up. But I want to thank you for your honesty, for your willingness to do this.
Yeah, sure.
And I hope, well, I don't hope. I know this is going to help a lot of families who have an addict that they love. And I know it's going to help some addicts that are trying to go back to being people instead of being called addicts. You know, I can honestly tell you I've always referred to you as Justin.
Yeah, I like my name. It's nice, isn't it?
You know, and that's a good thing to emphasize, and we'll end on that, is for people to understand your child might be an addict, but your child is still your child. And the addiction that has taken over their life, you can still love your child. And you can still be there for them without making it easier for them to use drugs. You can still be there for them so they know you care. You can answer the phone when they call. And you can decline to give them money because you love them. And they're going to get mad. They're going to be furious. They're going to call you names. They're going to hang up on you. But if you really love your kid more than you love heroin, meet them at Wendy's. Pay for their food. Don't stick $2 in their pocket. Thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
You've been listening to Stop Feeding the Predators on City of Angels Recovery Radio. And healing starts here.